And I hear everybody say that things are different today. Was it in that time? Or was it only yesterday? I saw you standing in the rain. And nothing's been the same since you came around. You came around, round, round, yeah. I've been walking on the sun. I just closed my eyes and then I'm gone. Hello and welcome back to the Tools of Ignorance podcast. I am Jonah Birnbaum alongside my partner in crime, as always, the monarch of Hudsonia, Mr. Hudson Belinsky. Excited to bring you episode 3 to cram into your ear holes, rather. Hudson, how are we doing today?
We are swell-tastic, Jonah. Absolutely swell-tastic.
Yeah, I've noticed that you've been using that word a little bit more frequently these days.
I have busted it out several times today. I'm trying to make it a thing.
Yeah, you know, we're getting into playoff mode here, so it's only appropriate that, you know, the vocabulary gets to, you know, postseason form.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, I've been sitting on Swell-tastic for a while, and I figure it's October. I really need to continue to use this a lot more and sort of expose the world to it. And so that's what we're doing. 8 or 9 people every week get to hear us talk about the word Swell-tastic.
Absolutely. And speaking of exposing the world to things, how about exposing the world to what we got on tap for this week's episode?
Awesome, yeah. So we're going to talk a little bit about Adam Greenberg, who made, he didn't make it to his debut, but he had recorded his first at-bat tonight as we're recording this. We're also going to talk about Melky Cabrera and how he's not going to play in the playoffs, despite being eligible to. And then we're going to talk to Ben Lindbergh, the editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus, our boss man. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about the A's and the Orioles and the unpredictability of baseball and some other fun things. And then we're going to talk about a couple of the rotations that have been announced for the playoffs and what we think of those rotations. And then you're going to what else are we going to talk about? Are we going to just let our audience cry and move on and wait until next week?
Yeah, we'll create a big gaping void in their lives that they won't be able to fill until next Wednesday morning. Certainly, I won't be able to fill that void in my own life with, you know, junk food and alcohol and what those vices that we resort to sometimes.
Okay, so Adam Greenberg, man.
This is a pretty great story. For those who didn't know a little bit about Greenberg's background, he made his major league debut 7 years ago on July 9, 2005. He steps to the plate for his first plate appearance and promptly gets plunked in the back of the head with the first pitch he sees, a 92-mile-an-hour fastball from Valerio de los Santos. Needless to say, that was the end of Greenberg's big league career. He suffered a concussion from the incident. He had to deal with vertigo, vision problems, issues that still plague him today. And recently, there's been some uproar on the internet about Greenberg, and certainly there was an internet petition that was circulating to try to get Adam his first official at bat, because considering he was plunked in the head, it only registered as a plate appearance, and it really caught steam, and a lot of people seemed to lend their support to the cause. And tonight, Adam's dreams were realized when he got to step to the plate against the putative NL Cy Young Award winner in R.A. Dickey, and he struck out on 3 pitches. But it certainly was a pretty uplifting story. What's surprising, however, is sort of the wide range of emotions that have that people have expressed towards the story. Some people feel that, you know, the act by the Marlins could be characterized as a publicity stunt. Certainly, some people feel it could undermine the integrity of the game. And I'm just going to throw it to you. I don't know what your sort of first visceral reaction was to this, Hudson.
I am happy for Adam Greenberg, and I think it was the right thing to do to give the guy an at bat. I think that just as a sort of side point, a plate appearance is just as good as an at-bat, in my opinion. It doesn't get you in certain record books or anything like that. But I just think that this is the second to last game of the season for two teams that are not going to the playoffs, two teams that are really don't give you many reasons to watch them at this point. I mean, Ari Dickey is always great to watch, but, you know, it gave the game some spectacle. And yeah, it was clearly, very clearly a publicity stunt, but I'm okay with that. And I just wonder if it does sort of set this precedent up for, like, things like this to happen in the future for September games that don't mean anything. It's October. Scratch all that. but you know, the point is the same. You know, does this sort of, you know, bring us to, you know, the other players who have had similar things happen and weird things happen? And do those guys just suddenly get chances in October now? And so that would be something to be cautious of, but I think for the time being, I'm just totally okay with Adam Greenberg getting his at-bat.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like he didn't establish a pretty solid career for himself in baseball, in the sense that he's a guy who made it to the big leagues originally, you know, on his own merits. He was called up in 2005 as a 24-year-old. And he was, you know, he was a September call-up, you know, just like anyone else. Mm-hmm. And he came into a big league game, and he just had something that was horribly unfortunate and even catastrophic happen to him. So, yes, you could argue that it does set a dangerous precedent. But, you know, this is a guy who might have even had, you know, a respectable career in Major League Baseball. So, you know what, I recognize how some people could feel it was a publicity stunt, and certainly it probably was. You know, wouldn't put it past the Marlins considering the season that they've sort of had to endure. But you know what? I'm happy for Adam Greenberg as well, and it's a shame that he had to face such a dominant pitcher. But you know what? I actually commend R.A. Dickey for approaching him and attacking him like a big league hitter, and he didn't sort of you know, condescend to him in a baseball sense, in that mm-hmm. he attacked him, he gave him his best stuff, you know, and he treated him like any other big leaguer. And ultimately, I think that's what Adam Greenberg would have wanted.
Right, right. And I wonder though, like, he had been playing independent league baseball recently, but, like, facing R.A. Dickey must be, like, the, like, scariest thing ever, because you have no idea what that pitch is going to do, and very, very little chance of making contact with it, even if you're Mike Trout or Miguel Cabrera. And here he is, this guy who has not played at any level close to this in several years. So, I mean, it's just sort of kind of silly and odd that it was against R.A. Dickey of all people.
Yeah, that's just sort of continuing the whole narrative of his misfortune. Like, there's no way to prepare for that.
Exactly.
No matter how many swings you take in the cage, you are never going to be prepared to face R.A. Dickey's knuckleball. It's just not going to happen. There are no drills you can go through that will adequately prepare you for that. So I think he was unlucky, because who knows? You know, because I think that if he had stepped to the plate and then, you know, had gotten a hit, maybe his would have gone down in the annals of baseball history as, like, the greatest one at-bat career in the history of baseball.
Mm-hmm. Well, he would have had a perfect on-base percentage for two plate appearances.
Yeah.
I wanted him to walk to get another plate appearance. And then I wanted him to walk again and just walk, like, six times in the past two games and then have a career next year.
Well, that's the thing, right? If he had walked and he hadn't registered that at-bat, would Ozzie have still have lifted him from the game? Would he have let him play defensively and actually, you know, sort of wait for his next plate appearance to see if he could actually register that at bat? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think Ozzie was particularly happy with any of this. I don't think he would have continued this and let him play in the field or do anything like that. But they might have re-signed him. They may have signed him again tomorrow and kept him on the team. But I mean, I just thought I had this like odd, like thought that maybe he could just be like this guy who just walked all the time and carved out an actual big league career after just this thing supposedly being a spectacle. But that's very clearly not going to happen. Very clearly, by the way he swung the bat, it was pretty obvious that he was not in any way, shape, or form a big leaguer waiting to happen.
Yeah. But you know what? Credit to him. He took his hacks. I don't think there was anything in the world. Like, R.A. Dickey could have intentionally walked him. I still think he would have swung the bat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There was nothing that was going to stop him from getting his rips in. And you know what? He took two violent hacks, and good for him.
Yeah. I would have bunted. Bunt yeah, down
that,
the line.
That would have been sort of anticlimactic, I think.
Do you think the Mets would have been pissed? Like, if he bunts down the third base line and they just didn't expect it at all and he gets a hit?
Yeah, I think David Wright would have been totally out to lunch. I don't even know if he would have fielded it. I think he would have just stared there, like jaw, like his mouth gaping, and just, did that really just happen?
Okay, so with that, did that really just happen out there? Let's talk about, Melky Cabrera. And Melky Cabrera's had just the weirdest season. It really has been the weirdest season. He was really just incredible when he was on the field. And then he's been off the field for some pretty bad reasons. The suspension for performance-enhancing drugs, testing positive for that, and the whole scandal to try and prove his innocence illegitimately. And now this... he's taken himself out of the running for a statistical award, and he's now not going to play in the playoffs. And that's the most recent development, is that Melky Cabrera will not be used in the playoffs, despite possibly being a huge boost to his team. So what are your thoughts on him not being allowed to play in the playoffs?
I don't agree with it personally. I think that I appreciate that they probably want to distance themselves from Melky Cabrera, considering what he's done, but he's still under contract. He's still eligible for their playoff roster, and he is, with the exception of Buster Posey, unequivocally their best offensive player. In 113 games, he totaled 4.6 wins above replacement. This guy can hit flat out. I suppose quite a few people might attribute that to performance-enhancing substances, but over the past two seasons, he's totaled 8.8 wins above replacement playing for the Royals in 2011 and coming to the Giants this year. I think it's a shame. I think that he could really fortify their lineup and give them depth that they certainly won't have with him not there. And I think that, to a certain degree, it's a little bit sanctimonious, because I think that they know that... I mean, I don't think that Major League Baseball... clubs are consciously delusional enough to think that their players aren't using performance-enhancing drugs. And I think that they probably have a decent understanding and idea of which players are using performance-enhancing drugs. They're simply, you know, these guys are kept in a confined space for 6 months out of the year, spending inordinate amount of time together. So I don't agree with it. I think that Melky Cabrera is exceptionally talented. He's in the prime of his career, and he could without a doubt be a huge help and a huge addition to any playoff lineup, to any lineup for that matter. And I think that this sets the table for the Giants. I believe they have a club option on him for next year. You can probably correct me if I'm wrong there, but I think
I'm not sure if they do. I genuinely am not sure. I'm gonna actually look that up, but while I respond, I think that it's very clear that Melky Cabrera could add to them offensively, and if they go through a playoff series and just don't hit, which is very likely given their team, they just don't hit very well. They're better than they were a year ago, but they're still not very good offensively. And so if they just don't hit, how are you going to justify to a fan base that you had this good player who's, you know, really, you mentioned outside of Posey, he's probably their best player this year offensively. And, you know, to not use him just seems like something that's going to be difficult to justify, but it also seems like using him may taint anything that is done by the team. So it's definitely not an easy thing, an easy decision to make. I would just say, in the absence of precedent for this type of thing, I would say just play him as soon as he was eligible to come back, because I believe that that must have happened at some point. A player must have come back from this type of suspension and played out at least the rest of the season, and helped to at least come close to winning a playoff spot or winning a playoff series. And so I think that it should just be treated that way. As soon as he's eligible to return, he's just back like any other suspension, and that's that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if the Giants don't hit in the playoffs and Melky ultimately decides, you know, I think he is bound for free agency if they don't exercise that option, which is, you know, I think that's going to happen. And I think that they'll regret it because, you know, deep someone's going to sign him. He's entering the prime of his career. And I think that this fiasco, this scandal, will certainly bring his price tag down considerably. And I think that he's going to sign on with somebody else. And I think that he'll still be a productive offensive player for a number of years. And deep down, eventually people let it go. I mean, yeah, I mean, you're always going to get those fans who like to harp on it and who like to, you know, sort of serve as a constant reminder of that transgression. But ultimately, he's going to catch on. He'll have success and people will forget. And then the Giants will be like, you know what, maybe we were wrong to sort of wave that sanctimonious flag in his face and leave him off the playoff roster. Because if they don't hit, if it comes down to that, if they don't hit, they're going to regret it. Maybe not immediately, but certainly down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And it, that's just a very likely thing that they won't hit. So, you know, and there is an argument to be made that he maybe have gotten out of shape a little bit, or he maybe not ready to just go face pitching on the biggest stage in the world in the playoffs. And so he might not be Melky Cabrera for a considerable amount of time. I mean, in the playoffs, and you may not want to take that risk. So, I mean, it's definitely not an easy question. I just think, in this series with this team, you need to use your offensive weapons wherever you can find them, and I think that he's more likely to help than he is to harm. So, unless you have anything else to add on Melky Cabrera, I think we can move on.
Yeah. Move on. In fact, let's take a break right now. When we come back, we'll be chatting with Editor-in-Chief of Baseball Prospectus, Ben Lindberg. Don't go away.
Welcome back to the podcast. Joining us, the editor-in-chief of Baseball Prospectus, our boss, Ben Lindberg. Ben, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for having me, and especially so early on in the run of podcasts. Normally, I am the guest people call in when they have exhausted every other possible guest, and the podcast has gotten stale already.
Yeah.
So well, thank you.
Well, I mean, you're our third guest, and mm-hmm. if you're anything like our other two guests, I mean, things are going to go well on this episode.
Yeah, that's a lot of pressure.
No pressure at all. Dirk Hayhurst was awesome. But
he was.
Okay, so what we kind of want to talk about is how weird this season has ended up being. We've got two teams that are going to make the playoffs. It's unclear as to in which role they'll be in the playoffs, but the Baltimore Orioles and the Oakland A's are both 92 and 68, both one game behind two very good teams, and are playoff teams. And nobody predicted that. Nobody ever. I don't think anyone. But those two teams are in the playoffs. And Ben, what the hell happened this year?
It's funny. I mean, I guess there are strange things that happen every season. Maybe not quite that strange if you're talking about teams that make the playoffs. But Coco Crisp actually said at the beginning of the season, or when he signed with the A's, that he was signing with the A's instead of the Rays because he wanted to win. And he was made fun of at the time. And it turns out that he picked a winner. I was asked about this by Mike Farron on XM, if he will allow me to name drop. And he asked me basically if we can take anything away from the Orioles and A's, or whether we can figure out why we were wrong, or whether there's some sort of quality that both teams had that we can pinpoint as something that would be likely to happen to a team that exceeds all expectations. And I don't know that there's one thing or two things or any number of things that we can take from this as necessarily the building block of a surprise team. I think the Orioles have had a lot of success because of their bullpen, which has been excellent, but it is also the element of a team that tends to fluctuate the most from year to year. Even good bullpens, you don't see as much consistency from one season to the next as you do with a good lineup or a good rotation. It's just something that's tough to count on. And as far as exceeding their Pythagorean record, you know, their number of runs scored and allowed, a lot of people have credited Buck Showalter for that, and it's possible that he does deserve some credit for that. But that also is not something that we've seen managers really be able to do consistently. Managers don't seem to have that ability from year to year to exceed those underlying numbers. And then the A's, of course, have this deep rotation and this all-rookie rotation right now, which is very unusual for a team to go into the playoffs with just a starting staff entirely made up of rookies, unless Brett Anderson is able to come back. And obviously that's not completely by choice. It's partly by injury. But even if you look at, say, the 2009 A's, they had a rotation full of rookies, and I believe they made even more starts by rookies that season. And that was a team that won, I think, 75 games. So it's tough to say that there's a secret. I think you can look at what the Orioles have done with their roster. Dan Duquette has been extremely active and has made many, many roster moves and has sort of treated his AAA team as almost an extension of his major league team, and has really made sure that the Orioles always have a full bench and a full bullpen, and they're just kind of always maximizing their 25-man roster. So I think that's something that you could say teams could take a lesson from, possibly. But again, the fact that they have been able to do that is sort of a product of the fact that they don't have a lot of really established regulars or stars. And I don't know that any general manager would necessarily want to be put in a position where he has to do that or has to rotate players all season to try to get an edge. I think most guys would probably rather just have a set lineup of productive players and be able to run it out there every day. So I don't know that there's anything we can take from these two teams that really allows us to spot the next surprise team coming. I don't know that either of those teams thought that they'd be as successful as they were. I sort of think that both teams thought they were at least a couple years away. If you look at preseason predictions and comments, which is something I'm doing for an article right now, you see that the Orioles said things about maybe being a 500 team and how that would represent progress. No one floated the idea of playoffs, and I don't think the A's felt much more confident about being a playoff team this year either. So I don't know if it's not something that those teams saw coming themselves. I'm not sure how bad we should feel about not seeing it either, but it's been exciting. And if anything, maybe we will be more likely to believe the next surprise team early in the season.
Ben, you mentioned how inexperienced and youthful for that matter, the A's rotation is. And certainly you look at guys like Malone, Parker, Griffin, and of course, Strand, Daly, and teams around the American League haven't really had that much exposure to guys like this. Do you think that's something that's working in their favor, sort of a case of teams don't have that much information simply because, you know, they haven't been around the big leagues that long, and it's something that they're capitalizing on and it's contributed to their success?
I think it could be a factor, yeah. I think advanced scouting has really improved to the point where even if you haven't seen a guy yourself, you can work up a pretty good game plan against him and watch a lot of video and see his statistical tendencies. And even if it's a guy coming right from the minors, you have pretty thorough scouting reports on him. But there's probably no real substitute for having stood in against a guy and seen his pitches yourself. So I think that's something that could be a factor. I think a lot of people have wondered whether the all-rookie rotation is really a good thing, or is it's a sign that the A's are in it for the long haul and are just kind of starting a run of success as opposed to having a one-year fluke. And I think there's something to that. If you look at team age, a young team tends to outperform our projections for it over the next few years, more so than an old team does. So I think it's certainly an optimistic thing. But if you look at the guys involved, I mean, just saying it's a bunch of rookies, you kind of have to dig deeper and see, well, who are the rookies? And obviously there are some promising pitchers in this rotation, but it's not like having five Chris Sales in a rotation or guys who have an ace ceiling for the most part. And so I think it's a good foundation. I think possibly that lack of familiarity could be something that has helped them this year. I don't know whether I would say that it's something that's still helping them at this point.
Mm-hmm. So these two teams are both going to be in the playoffs. And it's kind of with the A's, they don't really have a number one guy. They have a bunch of guys who are just good. And so, and the Orioles are, I mean, Chris Tillman's been great over the past month or two, but they also don't really have a clear, like, one. So how would you personally structure each team's rotation?
I guess I would go with Chen to start a series for the Orioles and probably Parker for the A's. I mean, unless Brett Anderson is able to return, and it seems like he might be able to return at least at some point this postseason. And I mean, beyond that, it's hard to say because these teams have, especially the Orioles, have had so much turnover in their rotation this year, and guys who started out as starters becoming relievers and coming back, and Steve Johnson now, who has pitched very well, seems to have some sort of knee injury, which may or may not be serious. But as you say, you would want Tillman to start somewhere early in a series. And as for the A's, I mean, beyond Parker, I guess you kind of keep going with Malone, certainly. But I guess I wrote an article recently about how the lack or having a playoff ace or a true number one affects a team's chances in the playoffs. And there is sort of a perception that a team that doesn't have a number one or a really dominant starter who can strike guys out and would be regarded as an ace, there's a perception that not having one of those guys really puts a team at a disadvantage in the playoffs. And it makes sense, or it seems to be intuitive when you think about it, that in the playoffs you get to really go heavy on those first couple guys in your rotation and pitch them on short rest and kind of avoid the four or five starters on your team. And so it seems likely that a team would have an advantage if it has an ace, but I found that there's really no perceptible effect there, and that the teams with aces don't do any better in the postseason than you would expect them to do just based on their regular season record. And there are a lot of possible reasons for that. As I said, aces tend to start on short rest, so maybe that kind of neutralizes their effectiveness a little bit, or maybe those teams tend to make up for not having an ace in other areas. But I don't know that it's something that we should really discount either the A's or the Orioles for not having a dominant number one guy. You can you can ding them a bit just for maybe not being as good all around teams as some of the other teams in the playoffs. And I would always tend to favor teams with a better record in the regular season or a better run differential at least. But I think the Orioles and the A's can get by in either a wild card game or a short series. It's not necessarily a huge handicap to have to go with someone like Parker or Chen. I mean, you'd always have a Verlander or a Sabathia or someone of that nature. But in the playoffs, it seems that those kind of normal rules don't really apply.
Ben, obviously, two guys who have been central to their to the A's success this year have been Yoenis Cespedes and Josh Reddick. Looking at their tools and their respective pedigrees, which player do you like more going forward?
I'd probably say Cespedes. It's funny. He's kind of been almost a microcosm of the A's in that he wasn't necessarily expected to contribute as soon as this year, or he wasn't certainly expected to put it together as quickly as he did. Obviously, the scouting reports entering the season were very promising, but few people seemed to think that when he was signed, at least, that he would start the year on the big league roster and flourish immediately. He seemed like a guy who'd maybe have to go to the minors and get some seasoning and learn some discipline and all that sort of thing. Clearly the physical tools were there, but the fact that he put it together so quickly, taken in tandem with those scouting reports that were so promising, I think obviously he's already kind of at his peak age, or would be for most players. It's possible that he'll have some more development left just because of his lack of experience compared to the guys of the same age. But I think given his production already and the tools, which are probably the most impressive of anyone on that team, I'd probably go with him. And that's certainly been one of the signings in terms of immediate return of the winter.
So here we are with 2 days left of the season when we're recording this. Which of these teams is going to win? What exactly is going to happen? Why? Is the world going to end in 2012?
There's not too much left up in the air, right? I think the Cardinals are going to hang on for the NL wild card, just because a 2-game deficit with 2 games left is a lot to overcome. It's certainly not surmountable, but it's not something we'd ever bet on happening. Most of the other stuff is decided. I would expect the Yankees to hold on in the AL East, just because I think they're the stronger team than the Orioles overall, and they're also playing the Red Sox while the Orioles are facing the Rays. So I'd expect them to hang on probably. And other than that, we know the identity of all the teams in the playoffs right now. So it looked for a while like there might be even more uncertainty when we got to this point in the season. As it has turned out, we know most of what's going on at this point, but there are still a couple of loose ends to tie up. But I don't think you'll see the end of season standings really looking any different from how they do right now. Although it would be exciting if we had a final day of the season like we did last year, where a bunch of things change and we have some last minute surprises. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that was the single greatest day in the history of baseball.
It really was. Yeah. It was a pretty incredible day. I think anyone who follows or covers baseball has some memory of that day and what they were doing and what they were watching and just the moment that all the incredible things happened. That was special, and it has maybe almost spoiled for the future, in that nothing is as exciting as that day was. But you wouldn't want that to happen every year, I guess, or it would cheapen to some extent.
There's a point to be made about this new wild card system, where we're going to have, at least I guess the idea was to have something similar to last year, but just all the time where there was always this one game and you're in or you're out type of thing. And now we're going to see, what's really awesome is that there are two division winners or two divisions that are still on the line in the AL that, I mean, I really just want to see Texas against New York in the World or in the wild card game, because I just think that'd be awesome. So like, just as a fan of underdog, but what do you think of the new wild card system in general? Are you a fan of it or no?
Yeah, I think I like it. I've flip flopped a bit since it was first announced. I guess my initial sort of visceral reaction was that I didn't want more teams in the playoffs, just because I enjoy the exclusivity of them compared to some other sports. But once I looked into it and saw that it wasn't so much more teams making the playoffs. I mean, it was a one-game playoff as the postseason. But I really do like how it put the wildcard team at a disadvantage and really decreases the odds that a wildcard team will make it deep into the playoffs. I think that's change for the better. And I know some people have looked at the system in the last week or so and said that maybe if we didn't have this current system, if we still had the old system, there would be cases that would be more exciting at this point, which I think is probably the case. But I think maybe it's a little short-sighted to judge the system based on how the very first season it's in use plays out. Obviously, from year to year, we will tend to see less exciting races or more exciting races, and it doesn't necessarily lead to the same amount of excitement every season. But I think the plan itself is sound. I definitely like the idea of putting more emphasis on winning the division and making the wild card teams really fight it out. And I guess I can see the other side. I can see the opinion of people who think that a one-game playoff is just not a great fit for baseball, and that it's a sport that really you need a longer series to establish which is the better team. And that's true, but I don't know that a five-game series or a seven-game series really gives you any kind of definitive indication of which team is the better one. So, I mean, I'm certainly going to enjoy it. I'm really looking forward to Friday and having two single elimination, almost football style games in baseball. It's going to be something we haven't really seen before and something that I think will be a lot of fun. So I guess we can kind of reassess after those games and maybe after the entire postseason is over, but I am still on board with the second wild card plan.
Ben, just before we let you go, which team from 2012 lends itself to a film adaptation? And is it possible we see Brad Pitt reprise his role in Moneyball 2, albeit a much older, more weathered version of Billy Bean?
That actually, it might be a better movie, depending on how the rest of the season goes for the A's. If they actually do have a more typical Hollywood ending, which Moneyball didn't really, if they were able to win a World Series, maybe you would see a Moneyball too. It's not entirely out of the question. But I don't know. I guess if the idea of what makes a good movie is an underdog and a team to win, you really better than the Orioles, who have had the least success in recent years, or even not so recent years. So I could certainly see the sort of narrative where you have the Orioles surprising everyone and the Eagles.
Awesome. Ben, just let our listeners know where they can find your stuff and where they can find you on Twitter.
They can find my stuff at Baseball Prospectus, baseballprospectus.com. And they can find me on Twitter at Ben Lindbergh, which is Ben underscore Lindbergh.
Awesome. Ben, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll be right back with more Tools of Ignorance podcast in just a second.
yourself what you wanted from me, babe. I feel you down deep inside.
Back to the podcast. So tonight we are sitting around watching the scores and reacting to what's happening tonight, because tonight is a very important night in terms of how this whole playoff thing is going to shake out. The first game, we talked plenty about the Baltimore Orioles, but we're briefly going to mention what they did tonight. They had two hits in tonight's game, and those two hits were enough. One of them was a home run from Chris Davis in the fourth inning, and that made the score 1-0. And the Orioles held on to that and picked up their 93rd win of the year. And then something else happened in New York, where the Yankees came from behind to beat the Boston Red Sox and pick up their 94th victory of the year. So going into tomorrow, when this show will be out, the Yankees have a one-game lead over Baltimore with 1 day left of the season. So it's looking like the Yankees will win that division, but it, you know, anything can happen. So, Jonah, a little bit about what happened tonight. Did you have your eyes on both games at the same time, or was it kind of just checking up here and there?
No, I was watching that Yankees game pretty much from like the seventh inning on, and it broke my heart. I was so confident when Andrew Bailey came in. I was like, he's going to lock this down, and Baltimore is going to be, you know, tied with the Yankees, and it didn't happen.
Mm. Yeah. Andrew Bailey, one of New Jersey's greater feats, but not tonight. He has struggled this season, and tonight was really a perfect example of that. Allowing the Yankees to come back in the bottom of the ninth and tie it on Voldemort's two-run home run. I mean, Raul Banya's Voldemort. He looks so much like Voldemort, by the way.
Yeah, it's really easy to confuse the two. And it's not fair, really, because he just harnessed his dark magic. You know, he swung that wand of his... Okay, now this is sounding... We're verging grossly on sexual innuendo, but yeah, Raul Ibanez hit a pretty mammoth two-run home run. It was mammoth in the context of the game, but it was just a frozen rope that happened to clear the fence at over the short porch in right field. And then, of course, in extra innings, he delivered the walk-off RBI single that just found a hole on the left side there. So yeah, there was certainly the dark magic was certainly flowing tonight at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, it was, and the Yankees won the game 4-3, and are now ahead. So the other race, which one should we do first, the NL race or the AL West race?
I personally find the AL West race so entertaining. I'm just cheering so hard for Billy Beane and Brad Pitt right now that. I'm really hoping that Oakland can find a way to take the division there so that they don't have to play in that, you know, do or die play-in game. But so, yeah, let's start there.
Yeah, so the A's, as of right now, lead 3-1. It is the bottom of the eighth inning. Roy Oswalt has entered the game with two outs. And the A's will have a chance to win the game and tie the division in the top of the ninth. And it's kind of just been this crazy season. It really has been a crazy year. The A's have been so, so good. I emailed someone from the A's who I'm pretty good friends with and said, congratulations. I have no idea how you guys did this yesterday when they clinched their playoff spot. And his response was something to the effect of, yeah, we just went out and scored more runs than the other team a lot, and that's how you're supposed to do it.
Yeah, more often than not, you will win the ball game when you score more runs than your opponent.
And so I shared that with the world and gave away all of the A's secrets, and now we know why the A's are good. They go out with the intention of scoring more runs than their opponent, and that has worked out for them this season.
Were you even at liberty to divulge that, to sort of disseminate their organizational philosophy of scoring more runs than the other team?
Well, if I revealed who told me that, he'd probably lose his job.
Yeah, you can't betray your source like that.
No, I mean, I know at least four people who work for the A's, so I should have said I know everyone. But so now I'm closing down my sources and anonymity, which is a difficult word to pronounce. But I think that since the Moneyball came out, everyone sort of knows that you need to score more than the other team.
While only paying $55 million a year in player salary. That's sort of the second part of that.
Right, right. I was watching the game earlier, and they, what's his name? Johnny Gomes, when he had come up, Jonas Cespedes was on first base and then, was picked off or caught stealing or whatever that counts as. And then the next batter was Gomes, and Gomes hit a home run, and now it's 3-1. And Cespedes is still... did Cespedes just get out? I don't have the game on in front of me. I wish I should, but I don't. I'm just an irresponsible podcast host.
You literally took the words out of my mouth. I was about to rebuke you as well. So we've established that Hudson is irresponsible, and Johnny Gomes looks severely high-waisted with the way he wears his pants.
He does.
But, yeah, Oakland has just been unbelievable at home, like unfathomably good. You look at somehow they managed to hit in their ballpark while other teams don't, and they also managed to not give up runs in their ballpark, which is staying consistent with their organizational philosophy of scoring more runs than the other team. But, you know, you look at what their staff has done at the Oco Coliseum. It's really remarkable, the ERA that they've managed to fashion at home. And, you know, ultimately that's one of the reasons why they've been so successful. You know, they say if you can play 500 on the road and then play well at home, you'll be good. They've been not only above 500 on the road, they've just been unbelievably good at home.
Mm-hmm. And so if they win that game, there will be one more game tomorrow, and the winner of that game will win the division, while the other one will have to play in the wild card game. And here's my dream scenario, is that both Baltimore and Oakland are in the playoffs, in the real playoffs, beyond the one game situario, half situation, half scenario.
So. Situario. Well done, sir.
Just pulled that one out. Yeah. So that'll be fun. It'll be a lot of fun tomorrow if the A's can hang on tonight. And it is now the top of the ninth. So we may be able to address that before this is over, before this podcast is over. But there was another pair of games that also mattered in a playoff race in the National League. The Dodgers entering tonight were two games behind the Cardinals with two games to play. And the Cardinals lost their game today against Cincinnati. And now the Dodgers are mounting a comeback against the Giants. The Giants have locked up, I believe, everything they can lock up, because the Reds and the Nationals are so far ahead of them that there's nothing that losing will do to them. And so the Dodgers now just scored a pair of runs in the bottom of the seventh on a A.J. Ellis two-run blast. And so it's now 4-3, and that also matters.
Yeah, I'm kind of pulling for the Dodgers. I just like, St. Louis won the World Series last year. It's so boring. Like, there are people out there who really like dynasties. I'm not sure I subscribe to that whole idea, because I just like seeing, you know, other teams. It's great seeing the Yankees in the playoffs every year, but for God's sakes, give someone else a chance. You got a little emotional there.
Yeah.
It's also kind of disturbing, speaking of A.J. Ellis, that among Dodgers, he has the highest wins above replacements for the entire season.
He's been
as
great.
A Dodger.
He's been great, and it doesn't really make a whole heck of a lot of sense. But, you know, I mean, that's how teams like that, you know, go from, you know, maybe they'll be 500 to maybe they'll make the playoffs to being in the playoffs and doing well. Is you have a couple of guys like that who step up and outperform expectations, and then there you are, and you're at the point where you can go make a trade for $10 billion in salary, like the Dodgers did. So as we continue to wind down, tomorrow could be a lot more fun, and we've been doing this show out on Wednesday thing, so we're missing out on a lot of the situarios that we could have discussed tomorrow. But the Oakland-Texas game is now the bottom of the top of the ninth has begun, and Josh Hamilton is at the plate. So if you're listening now, you know what happens. Don't ruin it for us.
Yeah. When I look at how the Boston blockbuster sort of worked out for the Dodgers, you can't help but feel like those big acquisitions kind of underperformed, and if they had sort of played up to their abilities in Los Angeles, they'd sort of be at a better point in the season right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there are other players who have been the upside that they brought in from those deals, though, was tremendous. Hanley Ramirez has not been horrible. Adrian Gonzalez has not been great. It's been kind of a type thing. They haven't. I think they're still. They definitely got better. They definitely got better. One thing I wonder about is, had that Ryan Dempster trade gone through, and Ryan Dempster has continued to be pretty good in the American League, but had that gone through, and maybe he adds another win to your team in this final 2-month stretch, maybe that, you know, that's the one who got away type of thing, and maybe they pulled the trigger on the wrong trade and they should have done that one and they did this one. I mean, it's a lot of second guessing, and that all happens right now. But I think just in general, they made moves that they had to make. They needed to be aggressive this year. And I think they've got a pretty good upside for next year.
Oh, there's no question. Mm-hmm. Certainly they acquired some big pieces that'll, you know, have a huge impact on their future. I just thought that they would sort of have a stronger, they would exert more of an influence on the immediate. Adrian Gonzalez has come in and he hasn't really been a stud. Mm-hmm. You know, he's accumulated 0.9 wins above replacement in 34 games. Hanley hasn't been hitting a whole lot either. Not to say that he's been underperforming, but I think that certainly Dodgers fans were expecting more when they acquired $897 billion in salary. Those are kind of...
They acquired the United States debt.
Exactly. Yeah. They can raise the debt ceiling together. I don't know what that term means. I'm just quoting something from the newsroom. But yeah, I think that they thought that those assets would pay off a little bit more this year, and they would sort of help bolster the postseason run. And I'm not sure that they've done that. Their performances haven't been bad. They just haven't been overwhelmingly good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they lost James Loney, which is just a horrible thing. It's just a horrible player to lose.
James Loney hit a home run tonight, so that totally supports your argument.
James Loney, every player that homers on October 2nd is Hall of Fame bound, and they let that one get away. Idiots.
Yeah, no, if history is any indication, anyone who's ever homered on October 2nd, I'm pretty sure, is already in the Hall of Fame.
Including James Loney. He was elected by the Veterans Committee tonight. He's in.
Yep.
He's in.
We're breaking this now.
They waived the eligibility requirements just for James Loney because he is just so obviously a first ballot no-doubter.
This means that Voldemort is also in the Hall of Fame, as is A.J. Ellis.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Voldemort, he's done his exploits outside of the baseball world have probably earned him a spot in the Hall of Fame. But,
that's true. That's very true.
Yeah.
It's sort of like how you grade the character of a person, though. That the Hall of Fame argument. Well, he was good, but he wasn't quite a Hall of Fame good. But he was a really good guy, so he's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah,
it's sort of the opposite going against Voldemort, but
both Voldemort and Ty Cobb did not pass the they didn't fulfill the character clause. That's sort of considered a prerequisite
Hall of Fame enshrinement. Do you think Voldemort ever bet on like wizard matches of any sort?
Oh, he was a degenerate Quidditch gambler.
Quidditch gambler. That makes more sense.
He would put obscene amounts of money on Slytherin, and God, my nerddom is just really manifesting right now. So,
well, he can't go into the Hall of Fame. You can't bet on a sport and then go to the Hall of Fame. That's silly.
But the one thing about Voldemort is he never bet on Quidditch teams that he was managing. Zing. Okay. Joke landed. That was my big accomplishment of the night.
Yes, and speaking of big accomplishments, the Oakland A's have won their game.
Huzzah.
So there is a tie in the AL West, and it's between the Oakland A's and the Texas Rangers, which is baseball makes no sense.
If that was something I tweeted like back in April, like, oh yeah, on October 3rd, the Texas Rangers and Oakland Athletics will be tied in the standings. I would have put that in quotes and attributed that to no one ever. That'd be, I like that bit on Twitter.
I like that too. Yeah.
Go-to bits. Mm-hmm. But yeah, nobody saw this coming. And hats off to Oakland. It's really been a remarkable season.
I mean, more teams really should be scoring more runs than their opponents.
They want to win.
Yeah, that's true. That's very
and
true.
If they want a movie, if they want to their season to turn into a film adaptation.
Exactly.
As we discussed.
So if we can move on a little bit, the Nats and the Reds have announced their playoff rotations, and there are a couple of different things going on with each rotation, but who would you like to discuss first?
Well, because there's no Steven Strasburg, I feel like, Washington doesn't even deserve their rotation doesn't deserve recognition. That's not true at all. But let's start with Cincinnati.
Cincinnati. So in game one, they're going to go with Johnny Cueto, who's good. And then they're going to go with Bronson Arroyo in game two, who has been very good this season. And then in game three, they're going to go with Matt Latos. It's a very good 1-2-3 punch. And the big names left out, the clear one is probably Homer Bailey, who's been pretty good this season.
Didn't he do something of note recently?
I think maybe, I don't know. Did he, throw, a perfect inning?
Something like that. We'll have to look that up. We'll have to goggle that.
He had a 1-2-3 inning.
That was it.
Something like that.
Pulled the Chapman.
He did. He pulled the Chapman. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So Homer Bailey's been, all seriousness, he's been very good this year. And after tonight's game, or entering tonight's action, he had an ERA 0.01 points higher than Bronson Arroyo. And I seriously wonder if that was the determining factor.
I think so. 1/100th? Is that what it was?
It's 3.75 versus 3.74.
So that's not a tenth. That's got to be 1/100th. I stopped taking math after.
That's 1/100th of a point.
Still got it. Yeah. Yeah, I was surprised, especially considering he threw a no-hitter, which, of course, really has no bearing on future performances. But, yeah, Bronson Arroyo is just one of those guys who goes out every day and has done so you know, every 5 days for the past, like, 20-something years or however long his career has lasted, and just delivered. He's been consistent. Certainly he's seen an improvement in his ERA this year, mm-hmm. which I guess you can attribute to a lower walk rate, because it's not like he's striking a whole lot of guys out. That's never really been his thing. Mm-hmm. And his ground ball rate is, you know, just over a percentage away from his career mark. So, yeah, I'm a little bit surprised that they went with Arroyo over Bailey, but perhaps you can help to expound on that.
Yeah, I mean, Bailey's been a lot better, especially in September. He's really sort of come into his zone here, and he's 2.01 ERA in September. He had an ERA of zero in his last start, cough, cough. But, you know, seriously, he's been very, very good, and it seems just like an odd decision to make when you have someone like Arroyo, who's just been, he's been good. He has, and he hasn't really been great at any point. I would say, certainly say that Homer Bailey has been great as this season has come to a close. So he seemed like a more logical choice. But there's the, I guess, the idea that Bronson Arroyo has pitched in the playoffs before, or been to the playoffs before, and is 35 versus 26. And when it's a difficult decision, like it's a somewhat difficult decision, because they are, on the whole, very close in terms of where they've been this year. But I guess I could see the veteran argument advancing Arroyo. It's not crazy, is really all I'm saying.
No, not at all, and I agree with you. I think that ultimately it's an experience thing. Arroyo has experience pitching in the postseason. Bailey does not, and they feel more comfortable giving Arroyo the ball in game two. It's I think, as simple as that, and they can use the numbers to justify whichever decision they made. You know, they just they sort of have the anecdotal support of veteran leadership, which I put in air quotes that you can't see and our listener can't see. But yeah, I mean, I really like that 1-2-3. I think Cueto really doesn't get the recognition he deserves. He's certainly one of the more unheralded, really, really good starting pitchers of the National League. He really placed a greater emphasis on the use of his changeup this year, and I think it's worked wonders. You know, he's had a sub 2.8 ERA in consecutive years. He managed to put up, 4.8 wins above replacement this year, and I think that one of the reasons for that is that he doesn't really have those sexy, obscene strikeout numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he gets a lot of ground balls. He keeps the ball in the ballpark, which is something that really it's sort of been a recent development over the past couple of years, because what he struggled with, you know, 2008, 2009, he was giving up a heck of a lot of home runs, and that's something he's really been able to mitigate over the past couple seasons, and that's, I think, one of the reasons why he's been so successful. But yeah, I think he's a guy who really should get more recognition around the league. Certainly with American League fans, I feel like most people, you know, he's certainly not a household name, but that's not fair, because he has pitched really, really, really well the past couple seasons.
Yeah, he's been really, really good. Last year he was... he had been injured for a significant portion of the season, and he still was really, really good when he was on the field. And he sort of made significant strides every year, and now he's this under 3 ERA guy, 217 innings this year, and that's outstanding. And 7 strikeouts per 9 this year, that's not terrible at all. That's a very respectable number, considering how well he does with keeping the ball in the ballpark, and, you know, doesn't walk a lot of people. He's very, very good, and he's certainly a very reasonable number one to go in a playoff series.
Absolutely, and on that note, I think we can move it over to the Washington Nationals.
So the Washington Nationals are starting Steven Strasburg in all 3 games.
As we all predicted.
As we all predicted. They announced that today. They have found new scientific evidence that says your arm will be fine so long as you pitch on 3 consecutive days every time. So
the 3 days clause,
the 3 days thing. Yeah. And so actually, Gio Gonzalez is going to start game one and Jordan Zimmermann is going to start game two. And they have not figured out who's going to start game three yet.
Do you have the hunch that it'll be Edwin Jackson?
I'm not sure. Edwin Jackson would make sense. But he's also, a little bit more volatile than a couple other candidates they have.
He's pretty erratic.
Yeah. He's kind of, he might be the best of what they have. They have Detweiler. It's really between Detweiler and Jackson, in my opinion. I don't think anyone has any, vision of John Lennon pitching in the playoffs or starting a playoff game.
No one's ever had a vision of John Lennon doing anything.
Well, that's not true. I could tell you some dreams that I've had.
Well, now I'm just uncomfortable.
Well, yeah. Chin-Ming Wong, also somewhat of a candidate. But, you know.
Especially if it was 2007.
Then they'd be in pretty good shape.
Yeah. Well, no.
Well, no. Everyone else would be bad.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, Edwin Jackson, too. I think that was before he was sort of, he had even been good at all.
Yeah.
That would be fun if we just looked at everyone's rotation 5 years ago, what it would have looked like. Indeed. Steven Strasburg, 91 to 92 out of high school. 91 to 92 just seems silly for him.
Yeah, that's like,
I'm not talking about his changeup. Yeah, yeah. Everyone would freak out, yeah.
I certainly would.
Yeah.
But if you look at Gio Gonzalez, he's really performed like a Cy Young candidate this year, and I think he's in that discussion. I think that it'll go to Dickey.
Narrative, man. Narrative. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No, you nailed it on the head. Dickey sort of has all the extraneous appeal that Gonzalez doesn't have. But, yeah, Gio's been phenomenal this year. 2.89 ERA, 5.4 wins above replacement. And he's managed to cut back on the walks, which really has been his problem that sort of plagued him, inconsistent control his whole career. And I know that a lot of people were skeptical that when he was leaving the spacious, even cavernous confines of the Oco Coliseum, his numbers would sort of take a hit, but that wasn't the case at all. And he's certainly in the absence of Strasburg. Him and Zimmermann have pitched, as good as any 1-2 in baseball, and probably even are pacing the league right now in that respect.
Mm-hmm. And Gio Gonzalez had cooled off significantly as he should have been expected to. In June and July, he was not nearly as good as he was in April and May. But then since in August, 2.64 ERA, 39 strikeouts and 44 and a third. And then September, October so far, 31 innings, 31 strikeouts, 13 walks. The walk rate has been key to his success this year, and he's really brought it down. And that was sort of the question on him was, is he ever going to be able to bring the walk rate down? And he has, and he's shown us what he can really do. And he's, I would argue that he's as good as any pitcher pitching in the playoffs. And Zimmermann has also been good. He's had his ups and downs, but he is definitely a guy that I would entrust with a second start in a playoff series. And then the big question is really Jackson or Detweiler. And I'm wondering how do you feel on that? Like, are you leaning any which way?
My visceral gut instinct is just to go with Edwin Jackson. Mm-hmm. There's no real rhyme or reason to it, honestly. I like the strikeout numbers. I like the fact that his ground ball rate is up this year. He is giving up a few more home runs than he usually does, but. I don't know. There's just something about him. Honestly, there's nothing really empirical to my choice. You can just, just like the case of Arroyo and Bailey, you can really justify either one. I like the strikeout numbers. I like the uptick in the ground ball rate. And pretty much that's about it. I don't know what your inclination would be.
See, I go with – it's a tough call because a guy like Jackson well, you just look at his last few starts. His last start was just horrible. An inning in the third, 9 earned runs. He just couldn't get anybody out. And then the start before that, 8 innings, 6 hits, 1 earned run, 6 strikeouts, no walks. And the lone run came on a solo blast. Game score of 72 in that start. And then his most recent start, a game score of 4. And I haven't gone back and looked at the numbers to see if he's really as inconsistent as he appears to be, but I would venture a guess I would guess that he's one of the most inconsistent pitchers in the game, with, you know, volatile, you know, 8 innings, 1 earned versus 8 earned, 1 inning type games often. And so it's sort of at that point, it's what do you think is more likely to happen? And are you willing to roll the dice on that? Or do you want what Russ Detweiler is more likely to do, which is probably the 6 innings, 3 earned quality start, and that's that. But you might get greatness out of Edwin Jackson. So it's sort of a philosophical question.
Right. It's the high risk, high reward versus, you know, consistent mediocrity. I would say that's sort of the framework. And if you look at Detweiler's past couple starts, he has not been effective either. In fact, his last outing, he lasted 2 1/3, gave up 7 runs, 3 of them earned. He walked 5, and in his previous start, he gave up 5 earned over 5. And over those 7 1/3 innings that encompass those past 2 outings, he's walked 8. So, yeah, again, I think it can be, again, you could use the experience frame of thought to sort of support your decision in that, you know, Jackson's sort of been around the block a few times and Detweiler's relatively, comparatively inexperienced. Mm-hmm. But really, again, like you said, you really hit the nail on the head. It's either high risk, high reward versus, you know, pretty predictable mediocrity.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so what do we have on tap next? I don't think we have anything on tap next. But if you'd like to discuss Mad Men, we can do that.
Sure, absolutely. Well, actually, we left off. You had just watched the pilot, and we had revealed to our audience that Don Draper, this sort of indulgent Lothario, has a family out in the burbs. You know, he's a Manhattan advertising creative director by day who swings the booze and you know, likes to enjoy the company of beautiful ladies. And then he comes home to wife and kids at night. So what happened in the second episode of Mad Men?
They start to develop the character of his wife. And
Betty.
Betty, yes. And she has some apparent medical issues. And going to see a shrink is sort of a looked down upon thing. And that's mostly the gist of the episode. I watched it like 4 days ago, so I'm sort of blanking a little bit on what happened, but I remember it being kind of more of like expository than it was like specific and big moments type thing. Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of, I would say that's definitely one of Mad Men's strong suits. It's that it is expository and they develop characters, you know, with extreme depth. And it's not to say that it's not plot oriented, but it's certainly the strong depth of character is what propels the series. It really makes them multidimensional. And Betty Draper is a fascinating character because I think she paints, obviously I didn't live through it, but she paints a good sort of caricature of what the 1950s and 60s housewife was like, and sort of the struggles, you know, predominantly internal struggles that they have to deal with, you know, their domestic responsibilities and reconcile that with their you know, with their other ambitions that they really don't get to see come to fruition. So, yeah, Betty's fascinating, and the whole plot line of her wrestling with the idea of going to see a shrink is something that Dawn certainly struggles with as the season goes on that you'll encounter. But, yeah, I don't know what your thoughts were on Betty or the family dynamic, but let's hear them.
It seems like it's very – they're basically just trying to expose the lifestyle in general and sort of set a standard for what's normal with these characters because like Don Draper in the first episode just comes off as this savant playboy type who can do whatever the hell he wants, and then you find out just at the end that he's married, and it's whoa, it's crazy. And then so they have to use this episode for that. And then there's also an aspect of this episode, the secretary, Peggy, the secretary, is sort of absenting, or she's not absenting, she's missing the absent Pete Campbell, the creep who she apparently had established some sort of a relationship with, who's off on his honeymoon. So,
oh boy, Pete and Trudy.
Yeah,
Pete. Yeah, Trudy's his wife. But yeah,
Pete's a snake, man.
Pete is a snake. Yes, you are very perceptive to pick up on that because nobody seems to like Pete, and I think we addressed that last week's episode. But yeah. I think as the series progresses a little, they try to show him in a little bit more of a sympathetic light, but still, people don't like Pete. He's not a likable guy. He's smarmy, and he's just, there's something, you know, just patently abhorrent about his character that really turns a lot of people off. And certainly, the relationship that him and Peggy strike up will lead to more shenanigans as the season goes on.
Nice. Okay, yeah. So, moving on. I think we're
moving out.
Moving out.
Moving out.
Moving out, okay. Fair enough.
That was my cue for you to segue out of the show, but you didn't pick up on it because it's 1:11 in the morning.
That's true. I also thought you might be making a Billy Joel reference, moving out.
That was the name of his musical, wasn't it?
That's true. That's very, yeah.
See?
So.
I was not referencing Billy Joel, but.
I have no idea. It's late. You mentioned it is late.
It's late. We're lost. I'm tired. I'm Canadian.
Canadian. That definitely is contributing to that. Mm-hmm. Your Canadian nature. Jonah, the next week of your life, what's that going to be like?
Yeah. Couple big couple games coming up for the Carleton Ravens men's baseball team with some serious playoff implications. So that'll keep me occupied, and we'll start up. We'll kick off the first round of the playoffs here with a team that's propelled by the likes of third baseman Ryan Kerstin, sporting phenomenal facial hair, and shortstop Steve Renault, who's just a pretty slick middle infielder, and of course our heart and soul Evan Hammond, who sits there behind the plate, and he's fun to watch. So that's my shameless plug for my teammates who were all asking for a shout out.
Awesome, dude. Awesome. Yeah, we should get some scouts to go see you.
No, you shouldn't, because I am to put it lightly, I'm terrible. I am a light-hitting first baseman whose probably best attribute is my proficiency for comic relief. So I play I on the 2-8 scouting scale. My tools, I don't think I have a tool that's above a 1.5. And I say that objectively, honestly, and I'm going to go cry now.
Okay, well, will you sign for like $50?
I would pay to sign. If someone was like, we'll give you a big league contract, but you have to, you know, whatever job you take for the rest of your life, you have to give us all of your salary. I would seriously consider doing that.
That's kind of interesting.
Would you?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, exactly. You don't even have to think. There's no hesitation. You don't even have to think about it.
Yeah.
It's the major leagues.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true.
What do you have coming up this week?
I have my fall break next week. So on Friday, I'm hopping on a plane and going to Phoenix, Arizona. And I'm going to scout Instructional League for several days. And then I'm going to watch Arizona Fall League games for another several days. And then I'll be back. And I'll just be watching lots of baseball and enjoying it and talking to people that I have interacted with much more online and over texting and over the phone than I have in person. So that'll be fun. And then just being in college and eating Cheetos and ramen noodles.
That is the life.
Yeah.
Seriously, watch baseball, scout baseball, ramen noodles, Cheetos, Mad Men. Why ever graduate?
Yeah. I'm kind of regretting that my clock is ticking.
Yeah, your Major League Service time clock has started, so you're approaching arbitration eligibility.
Yeah, well, I wonder, like, am I approaching my peak? Am I going to get better at this and then get much, much worse as my college career comes to a close? Or am I already past my peak? Because academically, I feel like I may be past my peak.
No, I feel like we're peaking now, like this, like literally at this moment. And as soon as we hit stop on the record, that'll sort of precipitate the decline. And everything we do after this moment will sort of be on the downswing of our careers.
Oh yeah, so we should just like talk for like another hour or two.
Yeah, but I could sing.
Can you?
I could
sing?
Do like a few minutes of observational
out?
Humor, perhaps.
Can you sing some of Moving Out?
If I'm so inclined. Only if you provide the accompaniment, the musical accompaniment.
Da, 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 da.
All right, stop.
Sorry. Sorry to not only you, but to anyone who's still listening.
No, they turned it off long ago. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for tuning in to the Tools of Ignorance podcast. I am Jonah Birnbaum. With me, as always, Hudson Belinsky. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next week.
Adios.
Follow you.